We do have a quorum now, so we can call the mini meeting to order officially. Marshall?
All right, I would like to call up for your attention House File 3055, and Chair Solberg is going to move this particular House File.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 3055 be recommended passed and based on general orders.
Right. Would you please explain the bill?
Madam Chair and members, this is the deficiency bill, and we have worked with the Department of Finance that comes as their recommendation. There are three of these are small agencies that come from special revenue funds: the chiropractors, the dentistry board, and the medicine board. They are contested cases that they need to pay, and they do have the funds available at this present time, but they're not allowed to pay them out without us appropriating the money. And so those three are from the special revenue funds. And the other one, the Historical Society, is actually the sesquicentennial. It's a general appropriation of $175,000. In the last legislative session, they were given an appropriation, and there were some restrictions on that appropriation. Some of it went to small grants, mini grants, and other things for the programming throughout the state. And then they were restricted on the amount of money that they could use for their staff. And at the present time, with that restriction being put in place, amount of money, they should really be laying off their staff in order to account for things like unemployment and vacation pay and all the other things that go along with terminating somebody. And this will bring them, for their staff only, through the celebration for the year, $175,000 additional money for the staff. There is another bill floating around for some additional resources for them for other parts of the sesquicentennial celebration. They've done a great job of raising private money, but it's real difficult to raise private money just to have staff supporters. Pretty easy to raise private money for an event or that type of thing. So that's the purpose of the 175. And again, we've worked with the governor's office and the Department of Finance on these, and these come as their recommendations. So with that, I stand for any questions, if there are any.
Do any members have questions? All right. Hearing none, then, Chair, would you please move the bill?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion then that House File 3055 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you.
The minutes are for February 19th are in your packet. Representative Hilty, would you be so kind as to move them? I saw that you were reading them carefully.
I was, in fact, Mr. Chair, and yes, I would move adopting.
Representative Hilty moves the approval of the minutes of February 19th, 2008. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. Then we'll go back to the agenda. Members, there are all kinds of other meetings going on, and there are conflicts. We will try to accommodate both the Republican and the minority members to make sure that everyone's here to be able to present amendments and so forth. So we have a delay, and if you are leaving and want to be able to come back in to offer something, let us know, and we'll be sending people to fetch you. The next bill up, House File 2553, Representative Winkler. The chair will move that House File 2553 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Many of you have heard this bill, some of you many, many times, and I will be brief. Certainly, we're all familiar with the August 1st bridge collapse. The survivor stories that we have all heard include a lot of very tragic things, most of which the state of Minnesota can't do anything about. The one thing that we can do, I think, is try to help to ensure that the financial cost of the bridge collapse for the families affected does not fall on them alone. The bridge bill that I have before you, House File 2553, attempts to address that problem. The first thing I think that's crucial to understand is that if the state of Minnesota does nothing to address it, the state has liability caps in place of $1 million for a single incident, up to $300,000 for any one individual. According to the numbers of people who were on the bridge, that would come out at, even if they were successful in a lawsuit and were able to recover to the fullest extent of those liability caps because of the procedural barriers that we have in place as well, the most that they could collect would be $6,000 a person to address hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical expenses, lost wages, future disability, pain and suffering. So the bridge compensation bill that I have before you is it doesn't affect the state's liability caps. It's purposefully an attempt to deal with this highly unusual situation in a unique way so that we don't affect the state liability caps that seems to work in general in most cases. The bill is divided into two sections. Section one is a concept in law, really, a catastrophe survivor compensation fund idea that is something that would be left in place. Section 2 is specific to 35W. It's important to note that no future compensation fund could ever be invoked or created absent an appropriation by the legislature and final enactment with the governor's signature. So Article 1 could never be invoked without a future legislative finding and appropriation. I'm not going to go through all of the details, but just a few of the highlights. Payments from the fund would not include punitive damages to any of the survivors. No attorney fees of any kind would be paid out from the fund. The fund would be administered by a third-party special master who is appointed by the Executive Council, which consists of the five constitutional officers of the state of Minnesota. The special master is limited in the administrative expenses to be paid out under the cap of 1%, and they would have to, the special master would report on their expenses to the Attorney General as well as to the legislature. The Executive Council has 30 days to appoint a special master. Once the special master receives an application for compensation from a survivor, the special master would have 120 days to provide a response. The survivor then would have 30 days after they receive that proposed compensation amount to decide whether or not they would accept it. If they do accept it, they would be obligated to sign a release of any lawsuit or any claim against the state of Minnesota. The type of release that they would need to sign is a type that's used in the legal system to bar any kind of double recovery by the victim. It's also, I think, a key point that the compensation amount would be only to fill the gap of expenses that other types of insurance or third-party resources wouldn't cover. So the idea is that survivors could not, for example, have 80% of their medical expenses paid and get 100% of their medical expense claims back from the state of Minnesota. There is an issue of there's an issue of whether third-party insurance companies could make a claim on some of that amount of money. We addressed that in the Commerce Committee. The administrators of the funds that potentially have a claim have indicated that they don't anticipate that the insurance the plans would come after any of those funds, and we have put in place a provision requiring them to notify the state within 60 days if they do intend to do that after an award is made. The special master would not distribute those funds until the 60-day window had passed. So the state would never actually give the money out to a survivor, only to have it taken by one of the insurance plans. Again, emphasizing that this is a unique response to a unique situation. There's no admission on state liability, and again, it does not affect the liability cap. The fund could receive gifts from third-party sources. Article 2 is specific to 35W. It starts with a legislative finding that the August 1st bridge collapse arose to the level of the type of catastrophe that would invoke the Survivor Compensation Fund described in Article 1. Again, 30 days to appoint the special master. Under the definition section, it's clear that you had to have been on the bridge to qualify for benefits. That's the definition of survivor. Under Section 2 of Article 2, Paragraph E, the emergency payment system that was set up last fall, which was capped at $20,000, would end once this fund was established.
Representative Winkler, we're going to kind of test some of this testimony a little short on it.
I'm done.
You're finished too. That's what I thought. The appropriation that's in here is a total of $40 million. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And that's what we'll be counting. We have two amendments. We have 13. A13. Is that okay? Representative McNamara, are you offering A13?
Yes, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
McNamara offers a House file amendment.
The A14 is out.
A14, do you want to take that one first?
13.
Is that okay? Is that yours?
Yep.
Representative Holberg moves amendment 82553A14. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you and I discussed this earlier today, and I also talked to the bill author. Basically, what this does is it limits the bill to the I-35W bridge collapse, in that it doesn't set up a perpetual catastrophe fund, but rather makes this a one-time occurrence to address that particular issue. So it's pretty straightforward.
Okay. Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, this is an issue that I know the members have raised previously, and I'm aware of it. The reason for doing this is that the state is very good, or not very good. The state knows how, anyway, in some fashion, to respond to natural disasters. We saw that on September 11th of this year when we responded with an aid package for southeastern Minnesota. In a situation where we have not dealt with it before, it has taken us some time to try to fashion a remedy that would make sense. The idea of leaving a general section in law would help to guide us in the future, is the thought. It's not a perpetual fund. It doesn't exist once this appropriation is over. It's merely leaving that language in place. And I guess one point I would make is that after a previous committee testimony, I had the Homeland Security Emergency Management Director of the City of St. Paul tell me off the record that having this first section in place in the stat in law would be enormously helpful from an emergency response point of view, because it's very important to people who are going through this kind of a disaster to have a sense that there is some kind of handoff in place that's ready. And so I think that there is a good reason for leaving it there. But it would never be used unless the legislature appropriated money again. It doesn't have any kind of ongoing automatic trigger or anything like that.
Okay. Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman and members, we had several hearings on this, and some of us have had several meetings with people who were victims. I will point out that three-quarters of the bridge is in my district, three of the four sides of it are. And the one thing that struck us again and again in talking to some of these incredibly brave people who had gone through this unbelievable experience for most of us, is that if at the time we were talking to them, if we had been able to point to something like this in statute, it would have been a tremendous relief to them. And in terms of the psychological damage that was perpetrated from August 1st on, because all they could see was all this effort going into bricks and mortar and no effort at all going into the flesh and blood that had been on them. You know, I mean, I'm obviously not a psychiatrist, but just when we said we're hoping to put something in place, you know, the light in their eyes, in thinking that could have been done was just, you know, it's just something that you can't write out in terms of fiscal impact or anything else. So I urge defeat of the amendment.
Other people? Other questions? Representative Osmond.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would speak in favor of the amendment. I know that as we looked at this in the Claims Committee, we also had mentioned that the catastrophe as it's outlined in the current bill literally includes everything, anything imaginable in your future. And you're going to have legislators are going to have people lining up saying, hey, it's in statute. I want you to put in a bill. I want some money for that. And it'll be all the way from major car accidents to, you know, building fires, or, you know, you just name it. This just leaves it wide open. This really helps to not only have a proposal in for precedents established, but it would then make it very clear that what we are doing in law is very specific to this particular incident.
Okay. Other discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler?
In case it wasn't clear, I would urge no vote on the amendment.
Other questions? If not, Representative Holbrook renews her motion up for amendment H-255-CA-14. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same
no.
sign?
No.
And amendment is not through. We have A-13. Representative McNamara, is that yours?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara moves. H-2553-A-13. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Winkler. My amendment deals with page 8 of the bill that deals with the grant, the $680,000 grant that will be through the Commissioner of Administration. My amendment would allow that money to go directly to the families and to the children and to their parents, and if they would decide that they want to spend their money in whatever kind of care it would be. I think it allows much more flexibility and would get the money in the hands of the family, and they could decide how to use it. And my hope is that the author will support the amendment.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I do oppose the amendment, and it is one that I have seen before. Representative Zellers and De La Forest, the lead on the State Government Finance Committee, showed it to me and raised it, but in response to that, I amended the grant section of the bill as it is now to have the money paid out over in 3 installments and to require a report back to the legislature on how it's being used, just to insert some basic accountability into what's going on. And I've spent a lot of time meeting with the people at Wade House, and the families and the community organizers and the community center there. And there is, I think to make a distinction between what the community center is providing and what the families are looking for isn't a real distinction. They are really coming together. And that institution has really been the place that has kept a lot of those families in getting to the resources that they need to address some of the challenges their kids are having. I think they'll be here in the coming weeks, and it's really something to see how they've come together.
Other discussion? Representative Kahn.
Let me point out, Mr. Chairman, also, instead of increasing the flexibility, this decreases the flexibility. There are actually physical health problems that the children still have. They're not quite as apparent unless you've talked to the people at Wade House and you've talked to the children themselves. But this is much more limiting than what's needed. And in terms of, also in terms of Wade House itself, the strain on its resources are, it's very difficult to understand how that was, you know, unless you've been talking to the people at Wade House and talking to the children and talking to the workers, how much that institution was a core help of importance. And what happened to these kids who were actually on this trip because they were outstanding people? They were being rewarded because of enormous achievements. And one of the things that they saw was just the deterioration of these kids who, you know, when you just looked at the television snippets, you thought, oh, isn't it great? Those kids are all right. But they're not all right, and there's a lot that needs to be done for mental health and physical health and for their core community anchor, which is the Wade House.
Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn, the amendment does say for mental health, so I think it's specific to mental health.
Yes.
Representative Winkler, if I could ask, maybe we are on the same page. If one of the parents went to Wade House and said, there's a certain amount I'd like, can I have $3,000 that's my child's share, and I've got a counselor or something that's been working with our family, would it be possible for us to go in that direction? Does your bill in its current form allow that? Would a parent be able to go to the Wade House and get that kind of help in somewhat of a proportionate share?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the grant is not designed to provide direct cash payments to families. And most grant-making organizations tend not to do that. A lot of it has to do with more case management, which is connecting families to the resources that are out there. This community is a high concentration of poverty in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis. The things that the kids are dealing with to get back on track in their lives are exacerbated by oftentimes living conditions that they're in, the economic instability that their families are in, and just keeping somebody on the case and kind of looking after what's going on and helping them find resources is a big part of what this does in a known central location for the community. And however, we do want to make sure that it's being done well, which is why we have the reporting requirement and the state's payment.
Other discussion on A13 amendment? If not, then the Representative McNamara renews his motion for Amendment A2553A13. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And the amendment does not prevail. We have the bill before us. Representative Anderson Kelleher, Madam Speaker.
Representative Winkler, I want to say something today to you because the next time we see this bill will be on the House floor, and unlikely that I will be speaking on the House floor. So I wanted to thank you for a couple of things today. I want to thank you for your courage in taking on this issue. I wanted to thank you for your compassion on this issue. I wanted to thank you for your caring. Many of us have been touched by the events of August 1st in innumerable ways, but none more than the folks who had their lives changed forever by that event. And it is our duty and our responsibility to respond to that. It is unfortunate in some ways that it's taken this long, but I think it's meant that we have one of the most thoughtful ways of doing this. And I think that for a first-term member to take the issue on, to work through with the survivors and those who are the survivors of the victims is quite extraordinary and is something that you should be commended for. And I know there's many people who have touched this bill and been involved in this bill, but sometimes, members, we should really point out when there's true leadership. And Representative Winkler, you have demonstrated that leadership, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to echo that comment, and I want to say that it's been so helpful to have you actually come out and visit with the children and visit with the parents. And we had one of the young women testify here the other day. She was actually talking about the fact that Wade House can meet all of the needs, and we need to also be dealing with some of the issues with the park that we're trying to develop just down the street from where she lives. But it has meant so much to folks. And I just want to say that after an initial meeting with some of the parents, and I believe the children around this bus constitute about a third of the victims who went down in that bridge collapse. A lot of them were very angry and very upset, and just didn't think government was going to do anything to help them. And this has really restored the faith of a lot of those people. So I just really, again, want to echo those words of thank you for your leadership.
Other discussion on the bill? Representative Kahn.
Just, Margaret, you left out about only two words, I think, and that's foresight and imagination. So many of us are used to just having someone hand us a bill and say, go with this, and that was not at all the case in this. Representative Winkler was the first person to stand up and say this needs to be done, did a huge amount of background
research on it before anyone got else got involved, and just, there can't be too many positive words added to that speech.
Other discussion? Representative
Holbrook. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, we had a discussion in civil law about the data practices, and I know that you've been really agreeable to working on that, and the concerns that were brought forth in that committee are also being worked on in the Senate, and those same concerns were brought forward, and that there's too thick of a shield on the process and the information and the lack of accountability as a result for a large amount of money. And so I just like to put on the record that we're continuing to work. Joel Carlson has been working on some language, and to get your assurance that you'll continue to work with us on that data practices issue so that we, for such a large expenditure, have a little more ability to ascertain how the money was distributed, what criteria was used, while still protecting the medical privacy, et cetera, of the recipients of the money.
Representative Winkler. And Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, you do have my assurance, and it's my understanding that one model that we're looking at is what the new Supreme Court standards for how they treat court records. And it may not be appropriate in all cases, but that's where I think we're going to start from.
All right. Thank you.
Other discussion? Other questions? If not, then the Chair would renew his motion that House File 2553 be recommended as passed and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Lynn, she stepped out, I know, and I think she's just outside the door. Representative Earhart, I don't know. It's maybe Mr. Marks can ask, or Mr. Hines, or Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, it's a slightly different format that the tax fiscal staff had been using, but basically the same information, the same array. I think it's I think just the formatting is a little bit different.
You see that this is pretty fresh, like 8 o'clock this morning, 8:08, and that's the staff makes us really look good, and they do a great job of getting us information.
All right,
8:08. I'm trying to give you a picture. Representative Polsky?
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, I have a question.
Sure.
We're going to receive a fiscal report next week. I anticipate that report will be more severe than the fiscal report that was done in the first week of December. Could you tell us, once we get that number, would this committee be the committee that would then set out how to address that deficit? And would we anticipate that all of the major fiscal committees would be receiving a negative target this session? And would have to address through negative targets the deficit? Is that the program for after Friday of next week?
Representative Pelosi, you're probably partially correct. One of the things I think we'll be dealing with is we always work off the governor's recommendations as well. And I've had conversations with the Department of Finance, and Commissioner Hansen, and others within that department to try to make sure that the governor gives us his recommendations as early as possible. We will then be, obviously, if it's positive, we'll have a smile on our face. If it's more negative, we'll have a grim thing, and we will be asking... this committee will have to do the balancing act. We will also be having to account for, at the present time, since the last bill passed this committee, that will be part of our expenditures, even though it won't be part of the forecast. Right now we have $40,175,000 plus some in the transportation bill that was passed. So I think our total right now is $43,777,000 as of right now in this committee.
Representative Solberg, I appreciate that. It's my understanding that the Senate fiscal divisions have already been given potential negative targets, and scenarios have been laid out in the Senate for a variety of scenarios, all of them negative. Since this is the Ways and Means Committee, I'm wondering if you would have such a scenario and that you might want to share that so that we could anticipate, those of us that are on the fiscal committees, what might be the ramifications of significant shortfall a week from today.
Representative Foster, we have not given the fiscal chairs a specific target of saying negative. What we have done with them and their fiscal staff is giving them directions to be prepared for and be looking for negative numbers as well. So I think even though the Senate may have done a little bit more formal of saying what is, I think in conversations with them, a percentage, what is a 3 or 2 or 5 or 7%, all those, our fiscal staff are prepared, hopefully, with their fiscal chairs to be anticipating and be looking at those particular savings, yes.
Representative Solberg, since there has been no formal plan laid before either the fiscal chairs or this committee, it would seem that there is somewhat of a dilemma. Then there are significant, large, hundreds of millions of dollars of potential bills that are being heard and moved through the House. Would you be able to say with confidence that there will be no new funding bills in the House this session, and that if there are any fiscal bills or targets established, they would be either likely flat or negative?
Representative Pelosi, I think your last part of your question is probably more accurate. This is the gatekeeper. Fiscal staff or chairs can move bills, but this is the responsibility of this committee is to balance the budget. And I think your last part of your statement is probably the accurate part.
Well, Representative Solberg, then it might be a good idea to make sure that it's understood by the members of the House that if they are carrying any type of new funding bill, that the prognosis for that bill is probably poor this session.
Is that, Representative Foskey, does that go for both sides of the political aisle? Because there's been lots of...
Representative Solberg, I did not say Republican or Democrat. I said the Minnesota House of Representatives.
I noticed that. I wanted to emphasize that. Okay? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. The Representative Linseski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File 3200, Mr. Chair. And if
Small one. Okay.
Representative
Linseski moves House File 3200. We recommend to pass. Representative Linseski.
Thank
you. Do you have amendments for this one?
There are none, I
okay, Representative Linseski.
Okay. Thank you, members. Actually, there's two bills that Representative Solberg has given me a hearing on here today that really are attempting to do the same thing. The first one is to get us into federal conformity. The second bill is going to do that, too, but attached to it are lots of tax bills that passed into the 2007 omnibus tax bill that went on to be vetoed by the governor that we believe were the non-controversial provisions. I guess with one exception, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But first, the first bill is the pure federal conformity bill. And members, what that is that in Minnesota, we conform to the federal tax system. We have been a conforming state basically since Reagan rehauled the federal tax code in 1986. And we have had, sometimes we have not conformed in a few pieces of the Minnesota income tax because we have not had the money. And those are the estate tax, and that has been bipartisan over the years. Neither party has conformed to that provision. Section 179, that neither party has conformed to that provision. Last year, you may recall, in the first few days of session, we had Representative Wolfslager carry the conformity bill. We did it for 1 year only. We conformed to all other provisions. This year, we're trying to do the same thing for 07 retroactively and permanently going forward. Again, not conforming to a state in Section 179, which we have not, as I said, we have not done for a number of years. But there's a couple more pieces that we're not going to conform to because we don't have the money. And that, and these were ones we did conform to last year on the floor. That is the tuition deduction and the teacher expensing. We'd like to try to get those in a second omnibus tax bill, but for where we are now, pre-deficit, as Representative Plowski just explained, the situation and the prognosis for funding this year, these are the provisions that we think with minimal expenditure brought forward in a revenue-neutral bill, we can get our Minnesota tax code conforming. So, Mr. Chair, if I may, it's probably just best to look at the spreadsheet since that's what this committee cares about. And there is a one-page House File 3200.
And the date on the spreadsheet on top is
2/21.
10/18 a.m.
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Linchevsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you go through the top piece through line, wait a minute, page 1 and go to page 2, you get all the way to line 38, and that is the federal conformity provision. That has all these conforming provisions to the income tax combined with three congressional tax pieces that were passed by Congress since we adjourned. And they really, the two that people are most aware of is what the actions Congress took to help people who are foreclosing on their homes so they can get deductions after they went into foreclosure. That's included here. And then secondly, of course, the big economic tax stimulus package that was passed bipartisanly by Congress and signed by President Bush just recently. So that's all in here, and it flows through to line 38. Then we're also raising a little more revenue in here to pay for this. The next lines show us how we're paying for this conformity. And those are the income tax bracket adjustment, and we'll explain that in just a minute. The repeal of deferred compensation exclusion for non-residents. These are people who earn money in Minnesota, move out of the state, and then don't pay their taxes to us, which we would like them to do. And then the contractor payment withholding, the 1099 requirement. These two items I just mentioned were in the 2007 omnibus tax bill, and as you recall, there were two 2007 omnibus tax bills that were vetoed. To kind of refer to the one that was vetoed after we left session, actually there were two vetoed, and the first one was with the income tax, the second was with foreign operating corporations. They were both vetoed, but they both included these provisions for raising revenue. And the reason I want to mention those two provisions, which together raised $3.4 million, is they were non-controversial. The governor did not cite them in his veto letter as pieces of funding that he would oppose. So the third piece of how we're going to pay for this, there's the two provisions that was in the veto tax bill that the governor did not oppose. The third piece is what we're calling an income tax bracket adjustment. And what that means is the Commissioner of Revenue, who is here, and oh, I saw him in here, I'm sure he can speak to this too. In my mind, this is the straight-up way to get to conformity. The Commissioner of Revenue adjusts the brackets for inflation every year in the income tax system. What this would do is say, we'll take the money we need to conform, which is a total of $4.3 million remaining, out of that bracket adjustment first, and then we'll turn that bracket adjustment back off as we go into 2 years from now. And so if you think about the income tax system in Minnesota raises $7.2 billion. This would be taking $4.3 million out of that whole bracket system to pay for conformity. All of conformity are income tax provisions, and they're basically tax relief to various people within the income tax system. And so the federal update, that's what we refer to it as in the tax committee, the federal update literally has hundreds of provisions of passing on tax relief to lots of groups in Minnesota. And so that's what this bill is attempting to do. There are provisions to help people with their charitable contributions, to conform with their IRAs when they give money, with their Roth IRAs. There are the ability for people to retire police officers to do things in their health care. There is the HSA pieces in here. So we can go into the level of detail you'd like, Mr. Chair, but there are many, many federal update provisions, and you can look through the actual bill summary to see them. But what we're trying to do is get them all done, except those few big ticket items that we just don't think we have the money for yet that we would like to address in the next bill. Again, paid for with two vetoed revenue raisers that the governor did not have a problem with, and this income tax bracket adjustment. So that's what's going on in this bill.
Members, I want you to, in your spreadsheet, if you look at minus line 44, I believe, and Representative Lencheski calling your attention to that. For the biennium, then, the cost of, at right now, you have conformity and you have it paid for in this bill. Is that correct?
That's right. We end up bringing this through as a revenue neutral bill.
Okay, very good. Questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple questions. Approximately how many filers are affected directly by this adjustment, and what's the, kind of on average, what does it mean for their increase in tax liability?
Representative Lencheski?
It's probably pretty hard to know. We'll let Mr. Michael take a shot at this, if this is okay. But I think one way to think about it is the two provisions that we were able to get through last year when we had money, those alone were about 160,000 filers. We can't even get to those people. So it's a number significantly less than that. But beyond individual filers is complexity, and it's multi-year complexity. So it can affect someone this year or not if we conform. But in year two or three or four, as they're doing depreciations in the schedule, it can continue to affect them. So it's probably hard to get a hard number around what it would be, but if I may, Mr. Chair, if
sure.
Mr. Michael could answer.
Michael, can you give enlighten us a little bit more?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, there, as I understand your question, you're wondering how many taxpayers would be affected by the bracket, by not expanding the brackets as much as would have occurred if this were not enacted. There are sort of two pieces to that question. I guess the one question which Representative Lencheski was talking about is how many taxpayers are there that would be affected by conformity? And then there's the question, well, how many taxpayers would be affected by the bracket with changes? And the answer to that is the taxpayers that would not be affected are the taxpayers who do not have enough taxable income to be out above the bottom bracket. And so I'm not sure, that's not something that we have looked at to see how many filers are only have income that's in the bottom bracket and not in the top two brackets. We could get that information for you. The second part of your question, and of course, the taxpayers that are up in the two top brackets but who benefit from one of the conformity provisions would guarantee to get a reduction compared to the bracket with adjustment. The second thing you asked is, well, what sort of the average, how much tax change will that affect people? We've done sort of a ballpark estimate for somebody that's affected by the most by this is going to be around $20. I think the average is going to be under $10. Now, and to put that into context, the complexity that's avoided by this, there's an element that I think all of us, it's easy to forget that, yes, in terms of the actual tax liability, there's a change that's going on, but there's also sort of an implicit cost to the complexity of not conforming to these seven federal laws. So in other words, there are people that have to spend more time filling out the additional forms. There may be some tax preparers that charge more, and those costs also need to be always kept in mind, because that's sort of an offset to this you know, actual precise change in tax liability that results from the bracket change.
And thank you, that really helped. What I was trying to get at is how wide was the range of taxpayers when the depth of, and if it affects a lot of taxpayers in both the second and third brackets, and that's a pretty big pool for a relatively small amount of money. Then my second question, I actually was in and had my taxes done on Monday, and actually suffered the growling and owling and consternation by my CPA about our lack of action and conformity and not being a member of the tax committee. I certainly didn't want to ask a lot of details of his, what was causing his stress, because I knew I probably wouldn't be able to have any meaningful response to it. But, I mean, is this bill going to move separately so we can get these things done as soon as possible? He told me that he has stacks of returns sitting that he's waiting to see what we do. And my understanding in talking to the administration is the big bill has a more uncertain future. I don't know if they're supporting a little one, I mean, how... I can't be the only legislator that's going to get growled at when they face their CBA in the next couple of weeks. So help me out here.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Holberg. And the commissioner is here. I would hope he would say that he supports this bill. And the next bill, with one exception, one piece in the bill, and we'll get to that. But Representative Holberg is raising a piece I omitted. The reason I'm here and now is because this all really needs to get done by March 1st, or it will not matter. If we don't conform immediately, we've already got about a quarter of the filers have filed, although the folks who tend to be affected by all these provisions usually are not filed yet. If we can get this done, kind of like last year, right away out of the suit, the CPAs and the taxpayers and the big software folks, TurboTax, they can get these into the form, so if people are doing their taxes, they're going to get the benefits will flow through these provisions. If we wait past maybe March 1st, it's probably too late. So that's why we're here now at the beginning of the session trying to get it done. The prognosis of implementation, I guess what I'd say, I'll give you, you know, truthfully, I like this pure bill the best. Great conformity, paid for in a straight up way within a revenue neutral way. But I think what we're going to do here today is lay this one over so we can have this discussion and leave it here. And then my understanding with working with Representative Fulberg is we're going to actually move the next one on to try to get that through the Senate, get everyone to agree to it, and get it signed. I would hope that if we can't pull that off, we could get back to this bill. Because what's pressing here is not members' bills. The members who have bills in the big omnibus tax bill, and they are bipartisan, and they are four caucus wide, and lots of people have a lot of interest in it, they are not pressing. You know, they can pass in May. They're not really relevant to this couple-week period here. This is what's relevant, is federal conformity. And so that's why we're trying to attach sort of bill pieces of 2007 omnibus bill with conformity in the second bill to kind of move it through the system, kind of motivating everyone to get it done. If that doesn't work, I would hope we can get to this one, because this is the timely issue, and it is related to people filing their taxes. Otherwise, we could just spend our time on this in May.
Well, and Mr. Chair, then I'm not exactly understanding why we'd lay this on the table, why we don't move this to the floor as well. And
well, there's a reason to not move it to the floor for both of them, unless you want to have me raise all kinds of money as it goes out, and we can spend money in ways and means. The staff tells me if you move both of them to the floor, since you have two different payments of this, then you actually are gaining money in this committee, because you're raising income tax, and then you're also doing accelerated June acceleration in the second bill. So if you move both of them, then I've got money to spend, and I'm reluctant to do that. Because I want to have some honest accounting of it. So in discussion with the Senate and others, we will take the second bill and we'll move that through, see what the prognosis of that is. We're having a discussion on this one so everyone knows what's in the bill. If that needs to be, we will then call a quick meeting and move this one through. but I do not want to have the staff put in a situation of kind of ignoring our rules and not being counting that particular money. As,
okay.
as Representative Pawlowski asked, how much money have we counted? And the staff is tracking that, or tracking that particular money.
Okay, and if I might just, a question and a comment. At this point, when is the tax bill, the big one, scheduled to be heard on the floor?
Well, I would assume that we could probably, I don't know if it would be Monday, Tuesday.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, my understanding is it's looking like Tuesday. And we are tried to get it in a form that the Senate could virtually concur and send it on that. Or they might make a change or two and then we'd have to concur. But we are under the gun to try to finish by the end of next week. So it's Tuesday is most likely to have that bill heard. And then if there's a problem, we still have time to go back to this. But I will tell you, Representative Holberg, just to be very clear, people have different objectives around here, and I want to be straight on mine. Those other member bills, while they're important to people, they are not of importance in time. So we're going that way now, but my intention would be that if we're going to lose conformity, I'm actually not interested in working on those other tax bills until we get to the next omnibus tax bill, because those really are not pressing today. And so I want to put pressure on the Senate, honestly, to make sure we get into conformity quickly, because that's the reason I'm moving forward. And, you know, I want to get there so that we are all, our tax code is working well. The other things are nice, but they're not needed in the next 2 weeks.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. One more question. I don't have a clue whether any of these conformity things would affect my return, but because I'm under the gun for higher ed funding and deadlines at colleges, et cetera, my returns are done, sent in. I'm filling out, you know, college financial aid applications based on those forms, et cetera. So what happens to a taxpayer that has their taxes all done, and then maybe there's some wonderful provision in here, I don't have a clue, it's going to save me all kinds of money.
Either that or cost you.
Hopefully not.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to ask Mr. Michael to explain the amendment process then, because if you went ahead and filed, and now if we pass this, there's some tax amount of money you were supposed to get back, you're going to be able to get it back. You have to go through an amended process. But every day that ticks, more filers are filing, so it makes more work for revenue to go back. You know, you're working through your FAFSA, and and I am too, so I understand that's a higher ed thing. But, if you're on that FAFSA, the FAFSA already for college application, you can estimate your income and your tax return. You don't even have to have your hard numbers to actually go through the process. But if you already filed and you did your hard numbers, you can go back if we pass this law and get the amended money that's due back to you. But if Mr. Michael, if you would permit, Mr. Michael.
Sure, Mr. Michael.
Just walk through that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way the Representative Lincheski described it is correct. That if someone, I guess the first observation is that most of the people who use preparers, I think the Department of Revenue has sort of advised them to hold off filing for taxpayers who have these conformity situations, and so it's likely that a bunch of them are holding returns waiting to see what the legislature does. I think the filing, from having talked with the Department of Revenue earlier this month, is down a little bit. Assistant Commissioner Manson just told me this morning, I think that about 300,000 people have filed to this point based on their latest count. So that's, I guess, the first point to make, is that a lot of people who have these situations probably have not filed yet. But if you did, let's take an example. If you're a retired police officer who opted for the $3,000 allocation of your pension to pay for health insurance under the new federal law, and you filed your return and then recomputed your state tax so that you paid tax on that $3,000 in all a variety of different ways that flows through the computation, you could then file an amended return and go back to the conformed way and get your tax back as a refund. I'm guessing that most people will have not done that, but there probably will be a few who have, and so then they would need to file an amended return. Now, just to make it clear on this bracket adjustment, None of that affects tax year 07 or tax year 08. It affects tax year 09, so that's off 2 years, because that's when the adjustments, the bracket adjustments, are made in September of 08 for tax year 09. So none of that's in play here.
Representative Earhart, your question on this bill, or is it your question related to the letter?
I have another question on that bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I'm so serious about the income tax bracket adjustment. Is that kind of like an accounting shift that we're going to make up to the people, or does that go on forever once you've made the...
Representative Lenzetsky?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Michael can add on here. You know, yes. I mean, the next bill has the bigger shift. You could call it that. It is an adjustment in a revenue-neutral way. Again, the way to think about it is of $7.7 billion of receipts coming in, it's taking out $4.3 million. And there's really, in this climate of the inability to sign a tax increase, this is the way to move it from 09 and 010, where the commissioner would take a little less in 09 and put it back in a little more in 10, and it would flow revenue neutral and turn off. So it's a one-time situation. It's not something the commissioner could do again and again.
Well,
but it would buy permanent conformity. Representative Wolfsager's bill, when we went back and conformed for 1 year, and we said, we'll do it in 1 year, last year on this floor in January, we said, let's conform for 06, and then the omnibus bill, we'll get all the rest of the years. Well, no omnibus bill got signed. This bill actually says, let's go back and fix 07 for everyone who's coming and filing, but let's do these conforming changes forever. So it pays for it in 09 and 10 in that bracket shift, and then turns it back off. It's a permanent
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jesse, it's not just $4.3 million, and it's millions of dollars over the lifetime of someone who got nicked on the conformity.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think that's accurate. If I could have Mr. Michael explain that, but I can see why you might think that, but I don't think that's what's going on. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, the best way to think about this is that it does two things. It affects two tax years. It affects tax year 2009, when the brackets will be slightly narrower than they would be under existing law, and so that will result, as we were discussing with Representative Holberg, in slightly higher taxes. In tax year 10, the brackets will be wider than they would to use up the additional revenue that resulted from that narrowing in tax year 09 that comes into the next biennium, and then that those brackets will be just enough wider to make this bill revenue neutral in the next biennium. After that, the brackets go back to the width that they would be under existing law for all future tax years. So this mechanism makes the bill revenue neutral over the two biennia, but after that, it's existing law plus conformity. So there would not be an ongoing effect on taxpayers as a result of this, other than those that benefit from conformity.
I like the questions being answered and asked, but those are kind of questions that were asked and answered in the tax committee as well. Representative Earhart.
Well, I must have missed the session.
Go ahead. You're fine.
Mr. Chairman, can we balance the budget by eliminating the, if we have $1 billion shortfall, can we balance the budget on eliminating the bracket creep here?
Representative Lenzetsky, we could probably balance it if we, in the out years, but not if we eliminate part of that. So, Representative Lenzetsky.
Mr. Chair, the bracket, the ability to adjust the bracket probably is about $20 million.
Okay.
For 1 year, and therefore we didn't even purchase the teacher expenses or the tuition deduction, because those two provisions alone would eat it all up. So we instead tried to do as much of the federal update as we possibly could, pass through the economic tax stimulus package to Congress, the foreclosure legislation, and get that all together here. But yeah, it's something that occurs to people fairly quickly, like, is that how we could get out of the deficit? No, it's a very small, the bracket movement is very small.
If you want to eliminate Representative Earhart's indexing and income tax, then we could have a strong discussion on that.
Well, it might be coming up. You don't know.
It might be. You can never tell. Other questions on House File 320?
Zero.
Another question. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lincheski, my question's, and maybe you are going to get to it, maybe you want to explain first. Section 8, page 9, starts with line 9.20. Mr. Chair and Representative Lincheski, I was just wondering, did you have some explanation? I'm trying to follow what's going on. This is a section of law that deals with employee definition, but yet your intent here is following along the lines of independent contractors, and I'm wondering, why is it not attached to that part of law? I'm trying to follow what's going on here.
Yes. Mr. Michael, can you answer that? Or Representative Lincheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McNamara, are you talking about the withholding the 1099 provision?
Correct.
We're missing what page of the bill you're on.
Page 9.
Section 8.
And I think in the spreadsheet, that appears on...
okay, so...
Which one? 41, line 41.
But where's my direction? If you look in the summary, Representative McNamara... Okay, so not to the bill. I think the way to read what's going on here is... It's page 5 of the summary, and it's section 8 that starts the bottom line. Requires construction contractors to withhold 2% of payments over to the next page. And this was a tax compliance provision, I believe it was carried by Representative Nelson, and was agreed to in the tax bill process. Both of the tax bills had this provision in it. I think. I know the second one did for sure. This was not cited in the governor's veto letter. So this actually does raise some revenue.
I believe it's $1
million. $1 million. And this is something that we thought from a tax compliance perspective, we really needed to take a look at this. We don't know, but we have heard that this is potentially a significant revenue source over time in Minnesota. And in fact, the omnibus tax bill contained language to have revenue report back to us over time as to how the implementation of this bill, Representative Nelson's bill, what would it actually generate? Because going forward, it could generate significantly more than that or less, but we don't know because Minnesota has not been doing it. And actually, the commissioner here and the assistant commissioner may be able to give you a lot more detail on that, but this was we worked with the Department of Revenue on trying to really get our numbers around, our heads around what this could raise, but it's quite uncertain. It could be significantly more than this.
And this appears also in both bills.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lincheski, this absolutely is not non-controversial. I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen here. So we are going to enter in a contract for $1,000 to have somebody do a service for us that clearly is an independent contractor. I'm assuming they meet the 12 criteria or gone through the checklist. Then we're going to deduct 2% of their money. And I was assuming we were going to deduct 2% of their money to make sure, and then they were going to get it back. Have we then not paid our bill in full to them? Do they have recourse to come back to us to make us pay the 2%? And then, that would be one question. Have we met their bill in full? What gives us the authority to not pay the bill in full?
Mr. Michael, maybe you can clarify that, or somebody else.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a misunderstanding. The way this provision works, and the department may want to come up and testify too, but essentially what this does is it says for certain categories of independent contractors that fall in these industry classes, which are basically construction, so just things like drywall hangers and that sort of thing. We're going to, rather than treat them like like contractors where you simply file a 1099 and report to the IRS and to the Department of Revenue the amount of payments that you made to them. Instead, we're going to have a withholding process similar to what's used for employees, but at a much lower rate, at a 2% rate. And so that withholding amount against the contractor will be a credit against their income tax liability that they owe to the state of Minnesota. And so if they owe no income tax liability because they don't have enough income or because they have large deductions or something like that, they will get that back as a refund. Similarly to an employee who has withholding against their wages, and if they don't have enough income to pay tax. Now the difference is they can't set their allowances at such a high level so that there's no withholding that applies. And the concern here is that there's a lot of these independent the concern is that there are a lot of these independent contractors that are simply never filing Minnesota tax returns, and by the time and some of these people are sort of transient people, and it's very hard for the Department of Revenue once they get the 1099 taped from the IRS sort of after the well after the tax year to sort of track these people down and say, why didn't you file for this, you know, this 1099 income that was reported to you? And so the feeling here is that when there's actually some withholding, that will increase filing and compliance by these taxpayers.
And I do remember the discussion of this in the tax bill committee last year, and there was, it was basically as we look at compliance. The auditor's report said, you know, there's about $1 billion in non-compliance. This is an attempt to get compliance into our tax code. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand it. And Representative Lucheski, I appreciate the fact that we try and get the folks that aren't paying. So if I understand it correctly, you refer to the contractor. I think you mean what I would call the independent contractor, not the contractor paying the money. Mr. Michael, you're referring to the person that you are paying the money to. In other words, if we take a landscape contractor and he's subbed out some work to remove some stumps, and you make a payment to them for $1,000, and he's not somebody who qualifies as a partnership, as a sole proprietor, because it looks like you're only picking out sole proprietors here. So it's someone that you. So now the contractor has to, not only under the old way where we would ask, are you not a corporation? We need to find out who are sole proprietors, who are partnerships. So it's one more layer of bureaucracy for our independent contractors trying to make a living in tough times and competing with different tax rates. So now they find out who the sole proprietors are and they withhold 2% of this money. The stump remover can get the money back if he's a legal person and operating within the constraints. Is that what you're telling me? They will get their money back, or the 2% is gone forever?
Mr. Michael?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, yes. Essentially, the contractor would make the $1,000, instead of paying the full $1,000 to the independent contractor, as you describe them, would withhold 2% of that, and then that 2% would be a credit against the independent contractor's tax liability, Minnesota tax liability, just like with an employee. When you withhold tax from your employee, that is a credit against the employee's individual income tax liability, and this would essentially work the same way. So when they file their return and report that income, if they have no liability, I mean, typically they would have more liability than that because they would be paying at 5% or 7% or 8% depending upon their income level. And so then they would have, you know, normally they're supposed to make estimated payments, but presumably then they will adjust their estimated payments to reflect the fact that this is a credit against their tax. But of course, if they're the type of individual that never files at all and simply, you know, moves on to another state or whatever to do more work, the state will at least have the 2%. They won't have the 3% if they were supposed to pay a 5%, or the 5% if they were supposed to pay a 7%. But the hope is that they will actually file and report and pay the full amount that they owe. And if they're currently a filer, they would presumably adjust their estimated payments so that taking into account the fact that this withholding is going on.
Mr. McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that if I understand it correctly, the $1 million is collected from people that are currently breaking the law. It's not collected from anybody that is currently conforming. All we've done here, the only negative would be that we're adding more bureaucracy for the hardworking people of Minnesota, but we're trying to collect $1 million or get a handle on the people that are currently breaking the law and misusing the system.
That's probably better than throwing them in jail.
Well, some of them, deserve to go to jail.
Right. Mr. Representative, yes, there's definitely going to be an increased burden on the contractor that makes payments to these people, because they will now have to verify, as you indicated, whether this is an individual or an entity other than a corporation, and then they will have to withhold, and they'll have to file the withholding return.
But are you finished?
No, I'm assuming, Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lunchewski, I noticed you did not ask for their federal ID or the Minnesota ID number. I would just ask, you asked for their Social Security number. The ID number may be better in the case of some sole providers to actually track them down. So you may want to look at that, Mr. Michael. These people deserve to be paying what they're supposed to be paying. But we shouldn't make the assumption that everybody that's an independent contractor is out doing the wrong thing. There's a lot of them that are, and I appreciate the efforts. I hope you're working with the administration. But the people running the train here, are the small business people of Minnesota that are working hard, doing the right thing. And we got to be careful. We put so much on their back and then wonder why they can't make it.
Representative Lunchewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative McNamara, I agree with you. There's definitely the administrative part, as you have acknowledged. There's also a cost to those same people who have to now, figure out who these people are and get their ID number. And that's a good point on, federal and Minnesota tax number. Those same people are going to have this sort of administrative burden to use the language you're using. They also have a bigger burden right now because everybody who's paying taxes is paying slightly more because some people are not. And you are right that the majority of people probably are playing by the rules. But there's enough information out there to say there's a bunch who aren't. And to the extent you can bring them into the system to close the tax gap, everybody, including those employers and all the contractors playing by the rules, are going to pay somewhat less. And so it is part of that whole movement we had last year to try to work toward tax compliance to help close the gap in that $1 billion we're not collecting.
Other discussion on House File 3200? If not, then the chair will lay House File 3200 on the table. And Representative Lenchewski.
Thank you, Mr.
Then
Chair.
Then the big one.
If I could move House File 3201.
Representative Lenchewski moves House File 3201. And I see there is an amendment. Do you want to take that one first?
Yes, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lenchewski moves House File H3201A10 and Representative Lunchewski.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think I have Mr. Michael explain the amendment. I believe we wanted to get our spreadsheet to zero to you, Mr. Chair, and we were off, I think, $45,000, so we took that amount out of the border city provision in the bill. We went down $45,000. I think that's basically the core of the amendment.
Okay. And this does bring it into balance then. And in the spreadsheet that is that you have in front of you, that's the 808 spreadsheet from today, reflects this amendment. Okay. So those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And carried. Okay, Representative Lunchewski, we've had a great discussion on part of this bill already.
Yes.
So we'll let you continue on. And
okay. Mr. Chair, thank you. I think for this committee's sake, we've got the full bill here, of course, and we've got the summary of the bill, just the summary of the bill, is 59 pages. So I don't think we even want to walk through the summary of the bill.
Representative Lisitsky, let's concentrate on
the
spreadsheet,
yes,
if you would. And then we can go to any questions that people have. I know that Representative Earhart has a question, as he's passed out at least a message from before.
Okay.
But let's try to concentrate on the spreadsheet, if you could.
Thank you for that. To the spreadsheet, then, again, it's dated today, and it's 8:08 a.m., and it's four pages. And if you take page one, go to page two, about a third of the way down. That's what we just went through. That's
right.
Federal conformity. Same piece, so we don't need to have to go over that. Then the next section, lines 39 through 43, that's the revenue raises in this bill. So what's in this bill are the two we just discussed at length with Representative McNamara, the one, the repeal of the deferred compensation exclusion for non-residents. We talked about that. There's another provision that was in the tax bill. It came from the Senate side, and that's to prohibit deduction for fine and penalties, raises a little bit of money, $260,000. And then there's some offsetting because we're going to pass on the subtraction to active duty military. And so that section there raises revenue combined at $3.5 million. Then the other piece is the acceleration of the June payments, the June accelerated. And this is the shift, or the gimmick, or whatever, if you will. It was raised in taxes, and this is more of a shift than the previous bill. It is sort of a straight-up income tax policy. This bill has the sort of shift, gimmick, whatever. What I should tell you in that, you know, not to disparage my bill too much here, but I want to be honest about it. This is what came through the veto tax bill and was not opposed by the governor. That's what this bill is built around, is revenues that were in the veto tax bill that were not opposed by the governor. I won't speak for the governor. The commissioner can. I don't think the commissioner is too wild about it either, but it was not cited in the veto letter, and my understanding that there is not opposition to using this revenue in this way, in this bill. But so you should know, in the vetoed omnibus tax bill, we went from the current law of 78% in the June accelerated sales tax to 85%. This goes from 78 to 80. So it's an improvement over the vetoed omnibus tax bill. So that revenue is laid out for you. So then if you get to page 3, you can see the total. That June accelerated provision is raising $6.2 million. So we're bringing all that revenue together to pay for what's in the bill. As you go down to line 48, you can see some of the low-cost items in the bill, because most of the bill, most of those 59 pages of the bill summary are non-cost items. They're very important to members, but they generally don't cost money to the state of Minnesota. So there is some spending then through the rest of the page. The first one is the sales and use tax, and that is our streamlined sales tax project. If we don't pass this, we're out of conformity. And what that is this whole initiative by many states to get our sales tax system into compliance with one another. And by being a part of that project, we actually count revenue to the state of Minnesota. If we fall out of conformity out of that project we're in, we actually have to, Representative Fulbert has to go back and take money out of the big bucket and actually grow the deficit. So we need to spend a little bit amount here so we can still count the money we're collecting, which I believe is about $40 million. I'm not sure the number. Ms. Dalton would have it, but I'm not sure what it is. So it's a small cost to keep us in this system of creating revenue. And then as you go down to page to number 54, you see we spent a little bit on this penalty provision. We did a little bit with border city allocations. We wanted to do more. We're bringing in a smaller number than we wanted to, but this is very important to the representatives who their districts abut other states, and they have to compete with their tax codes. Then we've got this ATV provision, which is a non-general fund provision. It flows out to a zero. We have to move things to the spreadsheet, but it comes out as a zero. That's actually not in the general fund. And then as you flip to the back page of the spreadsheet, there are some tax bills in here now in that top half. They're all zeroed out, and kind of why would they be on the spreadsheet? They don't cost anything, and we have, you know, probably 100 bills in this omnibus bill that don't cost anything. And why are these cited? They're cited because they actually raise money in the next biennium. So you can see they're actually bringing revenue in later. And some of it is because of some relief provided to people. They're not asking for as much of a property tax refund. There's a number of reasons some of these might raise revenue. And so then when you get down to the bottom of page 4, the second half of page 4, you can see all these things, how they flow out together. And, of course, Mr. Chair, on line 75, we get to the magic zero that we're looking for in this committee. So that's what's going on in this bill. So again, it's conformity plus a lot of members' bills, some of the same revenue sources, but the additional one being instead of this bracket adjustment, it's been accelerated, and that was in the vetoed omnibus tax bill, and our understanding, and it was not in the veto letter, that it is an acceptable revenue source for this bill. So that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Earhart, did you have a question on this one? You asked that, a letter be passed out, and I assume it is passed out.
It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that there's some controversial pieces in here, and one of them that I wanted to point out was this thing that's going on with the utilities tax. So is that the time for discussion of that,
sure.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Earhart.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I understand this, I'm going to give you a little history as I remember it. From last spring, we had a dust up on this a little bit with Representative Walsh. That 2003, Department of Revenue began a three-year rulemaking process to take a look at some city, county utilities, and they had multiple meetings and so forth, and tried to figure out what was going on with the utility tax, among other things, and they hired a national expert on utility property to assess and evaluate the state's valuation formula. And the administrative law judge determined that the state's valuation formula was overstating utility property values in some cases by up to 27%. So, this one was in effect the initial efforts then were to have the legislature, after they got their valuations reduced, immediately increase their tax rates. And that transpired last year in the bill. And the governor, what in effect we're doing is we're penalizing the taxpayers immediately for getting accurate information at the assessment of their property. And the governor cited this in his veto message as one of the objectionable items that was in the bill, and that was in the handout that I gave you, or outlined on the second page in blue. And, you know, after getting a lower valuation of property, we turn around and raise their rates. So what kind of a deal is that? Not much for the ratepayers or every one of you that have a utility bill. Because you should have got a reduction, so you're going to have the same or an increase. Well, that's
I want to interrupt you just a second, and that is, you should have gotten a reduction.
You would have.
Well, should have and would have are two different things, but continue on. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I think it'd be nice, Mr. Chairman, if the commissioner of, I see him over there, he hasn't got his hat on, so I can spot him. If he'd come up and testify on this matter.
Representative Earhart, do you have a specific question? We did take testimony in the tax committee on this, and if you have a question from the commissioner, I'll be glad to have the commissioner come up and ask.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask, when did this tax committee take place that I missed all of this stuff? I mean, last year?
Representative Vincheski, I was there. But
Representative Earhart, you missed the party. Where were you? I know where you were, because I'm on that committee too. The finance committee was meeting at the same time, and we had people coming and going, and there was something of quite a large interest in finance.
We had finished finance and went down to your committee after that, I think.
We did.
But it was, I want to say, Wednesday night.
We talked about this provision for well over an hour, just on this provision. But I think it's the more information, the better, Mr. Chair. But what I would say, Representative Earhart, your story was pretty good there. And what this committee should know, in addition to the dust up with Representative Wolfsberger, we had another one Wednesday night, and you missed it.
I apologize.
We went into it again. But, yes, the committee has struggled with this issue. We've spent a lot of time on it. It is the controversial provision in this bill, no doubt about it. And I think the part that makes it controversial is while there may be pieces in the big bill here that people view as, well, hey, I don't like that, so that's controversial to me. The term that it was controversial, non-controversial, meaning it was agreed on in the House and Senate, made it to the governor's desk, and was then not cited in the veto letter. The only provision that was cited in the veto letter, and Commissioner Ines can talk to that, is in the letter you passed out was this provision. I should tell you, I think they're, you know, Representative, myself and Senator Bach and Commissioner Ines all have a different view of the world as to if we had gotten to an agreement on this. And I think Commissioner Ines will come and tell you that he doesn't think we did, and I thought we did. So that's why it's in here. But that is the piece in the governor's veto letter that's still in this bill. Everything else was not cited as a problem by the governor.
Representative Ayer, did you want the commissioner to come forward?
Well, I think that I don't want to make the amendment to exclude this. And if I missed, I'm sorry. I don't know where I was, but
Representative Simpson,
hiding out from the moral majority or whoever is calling me, I think.
Representative Simpson did offer the amendment to remove it from the bill. So I know if he could have been there, you would have voted with Representative Simpson, but he did offer that amendment in the committee.
Well, Representative, we will give you the courtesy of that, of having the commissioner come forward.
Well, it would be interesting, yeah.
Sure.
Commissioner,
and welcome to the committee if you can identify yourself for the tape. And maybe what we should do is put your hat on when you come in so he can't find you. Commissioner, I don't know if there's a specific question or did you want to just make a statement?
Well, I think Representative Earhart's representation is accurate. One of how this all played out, we were obligated to change the valuation rule. We had an adverse decision in the tax court. We also had the national experts that our rule was really not legally defensible any longer. So we went into a long process of coming out with a new valuation rule. In fact, in that valuation rule, we were very cognizant of the fact that this change would have a consequence for local units of government, host communities. And so we actually phased in the rule over 3 years to provide a buffer, some time to adjust. And so we were cognizant of this, and also in the governor's budget, we also had some transition aid that we recommended to soften the blow, the property tax impact. When the veto bill came to the governor's desk, we thoroughly vetted this bill, and there were many provisions in the bill that, from our perspective, were less than ideal. I mean, it was a 350-page omnibus bill. By its very nature, there were many provisions that were not ideal from our perspective, but we limited the governor's veto message to really focusing on four primary issues, and that was the Mall of America provision. It was the way the property tax loop was distributed. It was the inflation provision, of course. And then it was the utility class rate change. So we really thought these were the first tier issues of concern for the governor, and that's why we flagged them in the veto message. And so for this vehicle, which was represented to us as being kind of agreed upon, fast track, I don't know if actually the word non-controversial was used, but I took it as, when you say a fast track tax bill of agreed upon items, I kind of convert that to a non-controversial bill. I think this provision rises to a level of controversy. And I know that the chair and I have a difference of opinion, honest difference of opinion, of what, if any, agreement was ever reached back in July and August when we were talking about trying to negotiate a tax bill, maybe a special session. To me, that was a different time and place. I don't think there ever was a final agreement reached. But just by virtue of the fact that this was referenced in the governor's veto message, I think it rises to a different level. And this is, from our perspective, not the appropriate vehicle to resolve this issue.
I'm sure that you can give the governor advice differently than what was last year as well. You're so good at that.
No comment.
Other questions? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was in the tax committee the other night and heard the entire discussion, and a couple of points that I would like to make are from the standpoint of compromise. Yes, the governor identified four areas. Three of them are out of the bill. This one remains in, but it's not the same language that was in the vetoed bill. It is different language, and so we're not moving forward exactly the same language either. And, you know, if you were to talk about three-quarters of a loaf or even more, being it was just a change, I think the legislature has moved a long way in terms of the issues that were identified in the bill that we've tried to have as non-controversial as possible.
Chairman, Representative,
Commissioner.
I'll stipulate the fact that it is a different provision, the lower class rate that was in the V4 bill. But I don't think that substantively changed, that this was never resolved between the two parties. There was many issues actually where there were more resolved than this back in July and August, and they're not in the tax bill today. For example, the Job Z, the two taxpayers and myself have agreed to the Job Z compromise. You know, I think I don't expect that to be in this bill. I think it would be unreasonable to expect that to be in this bill, even though there was a three-way agreement back in July and August. I just think this bill is supposed to be, if we really want to pass this thing by March 1st, and I applaud the tax chair for trying to do everything possible to get federal conformity as much as financially feasible passed by March 1st. That's a very ambitious goal. And we applaud that, but this provision causes us much pause.
Representative Holbrook. Representative Earhart, I'm sorry, you still had the floor. Did you have more?
Well, I do have one other. Think I understand this, that there was a revenue stabilization agreement made between Xcel Energy and at least Red Wing and Goodhue counties, which said that they would make sure that they made payments to the local governments to hold them revenue neutral as to what the payments were before the rulemaking started. And that was also offered to Monticello, Wright County, Becker, and Sherburne County. Now, why wouldn't that have been sufficient to satisfy this thing without jacking their rates up again?
Well, and Representative Earhart, keep in mind that there are other generating plants that have this same concern, and other communities that have this same concern. Cohasset, Itasca County, Grand Rapids School District, others have the same concern. And that has not, I don't think, been part of some of those negotiations. Representative Linchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think they call it an RSA, is this agreement that the utilities had with some of the whole cities. And I think that's accurate, that there were some agreements with some of the cities by some of the utilities. There certainly weren't all the utilities or all of the cities, and I don't think they agreed on the deals these communities agreed on with were revenue neutral. They weren't held whole. They were getting something. But that's actually a separate negotiation between a city and a utility. It's really not the legislature's deal. Let's say they all agreed and they all held hands and they were all great. We can still change the law. And so, you know, you are accurate in saying, look, these guys came in, sued the Department of Revenue and said, you guys are overvaluing us, and they won. I mean, they won. And so, well, the legislature turns around and raises property taxes on them and just, you know, hey, there's no difference. Well, I mean, that is one way to look at it. I mean, the way I would look at it is we have the ability to do that. We are the legislature. That's not double taxation. I mean, we think of us as individuals. We pay sales tax and property tax and income tax and gas tax. And the fact that someone may pay another tax is not somehow an unfairness if you believe that they're not contributing to these host communities in a way that makes it worth the risk to those communities to fulfill, you know, house these facilities. And I think that's the core of the debate for the affected communities. Hey, we're the host community. We took these nuclear plants on or whatever because we're getting a tax benefit. Now we're losing that tax benefit. So, hey, legislature, what are you going to do about that? You know, now we're in a tough spot. And we've been responding to those communities who have made effective arguments that you know, we're the host communities bearing the burdens. To your question of, you know, then you're flowing it to the consumers or to the ratepayers. True. And I would argue that's exactly how you should do it. Who are the beneficiaries of these utilities, of this energy being produced? We are. We're consuming it. And so businesses don't pay tax entities. They flow it down to consumers. And those taxes are regressive, and we pick those up as consumers. So you can say, well, why should all the ratepayers pay? You know, I guess that's the tax base of all ratepayers in Minnesota paying, or just those people live in those cities. I mean, then they eat the tax burden for all of us who use the power. So, I mean, just from a purely economic standpoint, I mean, we are the consumers of the good. We probably should pay it. And the utilities can pass on these tax burdens directly in rates, and will, as you've rightfully stated. But I think that is the right tax base to be eating the cost for these communities that are hosting these facilities for all of our benefit.
Representative, are you finished?
Well, I just wanted to mention one other thing,
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman. I wish you'd make that speech about businesses and who pays the taxes when the chamber and the business partnership is up sitting around here listening. I think part of them are, because you're right. But besides that, there's a huge chunk of income being paid out by the utilities companies that we didn't talk about, and that's the personal property taxes. Because of their special creation and law there, they have other assets that we're taxing, which really jacks it up when you look at the combined amount. But that's...
Okay. Representative Holberg, you had a question?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my comments were related to Senator Carlson's comments regarding compromise, and I think what we also have to remember is a lot of things have changed since May relative to the state's budget. With the deficit projection in November, most believe that that is going to grow. The impacts of the housing industry. Certainly, I was not privy to any of these negotiations or whatever, but it's been pretty clear from what I understand that this big bill is not headed for a soft landing in the governor's office. And just one component of it, the deed tax in Dakota County. When you look at what's happening to the housing industry, you know, I, for one, don't think now's the time to add a tax onto the housing industry in Dakota County. I mean, I'm hoping that we'll take a second look at that. So I'm hoping that from the sounds of it, we're on Tuesday going to do this big bill. Hopefully that moves rapidly and has what most believe is a pretty predictable result, and that we can get the little bill going and help.
Sounds like a blue pen to me.
Help my poor accountant who has stacks and stacks of files sitting around his office so he doesn't have to growl at anybody else next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I missed your committee the other night. I don't know where I was.
That's just fine, Representative Earhart. That's good. Representative McInnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed the committee too, Representative Earhart, but I'm not on it. Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I do have a question, and I feel it's appropriate because Representative Lunchesky said my question on the earlier bill is in this bill also. I was thinking, as this is going on, we have a provision in Minnesota law, and I believe we still have it. I tried to make a quick call back to my former place of work, and the lady was not there, where people at work under state contracts, and before they get their final payment, we require them to fill out a form. And I worked hard the first couple of years I was in the legislature to finally be able to do this electronically. We had this antiquated system that literally people had to go and come to the building. And I'm wondering if one of these folks that's in the audience is familiar with the form I'm talking about. It guarantees that people under state contract, before they get the final payment, are not behind in their state withholding. And it seems to me that we should use that principle instead of going after everybody, allow them that we check the withholding, and now today we can do that electronically. And I would just ask Representative Lunchesky, and what I would be more apt to do is to increase that percentage to where it's significant, to where instead of making it a 2% withholding, look at the opportunity that it be stronger. Or we don't make that final payment. That's the way it is under Minnesota law. We can't get paid from, and now that I think about it, it's any public sector that we would work for. The city of St. Paul would not distribute the final payment to a contractor, and I can't believe it. It's the trouble when you get old. I can't remember this form, but it's...
Just wait. Form.
Yeah.
See what it's like after.
Representative Solberg, you and I both, maybe. But there is a form that we fill out in a public sector contract that we used to do, and I believe it's made easier. But if we could look at that opportunity, and I hope the administration supports the idea that there is a group that's fallen through the cracks and the legitimate people are getting hurt.
So did you have a question specifically?
Well, I can't believe I'm embarrassed to say that nobody over there knows the form I'm talking about. Thank you very much, sir. I see 134.
There you go.
134, I believe.
Very good.
Now, if I remember.
We won't even require you to identify your name for the tape.
It's the IC 134, I believe, is what it is, if I'm not mistaken. And it is a form that we require contractors to file that they're not behind in their withholdings. And I think we could do the same in that, and I hope we'll look at that opportunity. That's another possibility. Thank you, Mr. Roof.
Yes. Commissioner?
Kevin, real quick, Representative McNamara, in the interest of full disclosure, the 2% withholding actually is a department proposal that we proposed 3 years running. And we really identified an area where there was a high level of noncompliance. We think this is kind of a strategic way of trying to get at that and chip away at that noncompliance rate and really level the playing field for those employers who are doing the right thing and who are doing the right thing.
Representative McNamara?
Well, as one of those that sits around the table and makes this big money and has been there before.
We've been telling you that for a long time.
Yeah, our $31,000, which really is about $40,000. I think if you look at the IC-134 idea, you will be able to go after and you will be able to withhold all the money to those folks if they're in arrears, and we'll be able to know that we're dealing with legal people. I think it's an opportunity.
I think the question may be, though, as I understand it, that if they haven't filed, they may not know if they're in arrears or not.
In regards to, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, in regards to the IC-134, if there's doubt, they don't get the money.
Okay, other questions on the bill? Any other questions? Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in closing, you know, we did spend a little time on this provision, and there, you know, there's more time to think and work on it, and we've had some communication and miscommunication. But I want to go back just before we vote here on what Representative Carlson said. I mean, we focused on the federal conformity here, which is the time-pressing piece. We've just passed the 100 bills that are in the tax bill and not talked about them at all. Focused on this one provision. And I want to remind people that this is the omnibus tax bill of 2007, minus all the big ticket items that we don't have the money for now, like LGA and, you know, all these things people are buying. But the bill itself has lots of member bills for all kinds of initiatives. We've got all kinds of things for veterans in here. We have property tax reductions for different groups of people. We have tax increment finance districts in the bills. We have local option sales tax in the bills. We have a minerals article. The list goes on and on. There's nothing unaffected in the tax code in this bill. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue to work through with both the governor and Commissioner Innes and Senator Bach and the Senate to get this done by March 1st to get the federal conformity out of the way and bring these bills through. And I think everyone has the best intention to just continue on forward and get it done.
Okay. Other discussion? If not, then the Chair or Representative Lencheski renews their motion that House File 3201, as amended, be recommended passed and placed in the General Registry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? And carried.
Thank you, Mr.
Members, no meeting Monday? We'll keep posted for the next one.
Any tentative agenda for next
not
week?
Not at the present time. We'll have to be waiting now, probably until, I think we've everything's on off, and probably wait until March 3rd now, when our meeting is for there's a change that I'll let you know. But I don't think they look forward to there's nothing that's pressing.
All right, thank you.
So the meeting is adjourned.